This episode of the UAV Digest is sponsored by GoEngineer, provider of design, engineering, and 3D printing solutions for the aerospace and unmanned vehicles industries. To learn more, visit the UAVDigest.com/GoEngineer. You're listening to episode 65 of the UAV Digest. I'm Max Flight in Hartford, Connecticut.
And I'm David Vanderhoof in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Hey, Max, we got a really cool episode this week, don't we?
We do. We have something quite a bit different and very special, thanks to one of our friends and listeners. And we've got something unusual to bring to all you listeners.
Let's first say that we have a really good friend who went out of his way to do this for us. And he is Carl Valeri. He has the Aviation Careers Podcast, and he's also on the Stuck Mike Avcast and has been a guest on Airplane Geeks. And he was at the NBAA convention, which is the National Business Aviation Association. And their convention usually is in Orlando this time of year. And they had a, surprisingly, an unmanned aircraft systems regulatory and legal developments panel, which Carl went to. And for our listeners, and he knew that Max and I would get psyched about this, recorded the panel.
That's right. And we've got some clips from the conversation that we're going to provide for you this episode. And we don't have all of them queued up. The recording runs about an hour in total. So we're just going to kind of tackle the first half of it.
Yeah. Now, we're going to apologize in advance. There is a lot of background noise. Keep in mind, this is a convention. So the audio quality is not up to our normal or the Max Flight standard of audio quality, but we'll make do. And I think the content will outvalue the fact of the little bit of poor quality.
All right, David. So what do you say we get started right away?
All right. Well, first, folks, the Unmanned Aircraft Systems Regulatory and Legal Developments panel was moderated by Mark Warren of Crowell and Mooring LLP. The members of the panel were as follows: Dean Griffiths from the FAA, Mario Marilina of AUVSI, the Government Relations, Dave Hamrick, MITRE Corporation, MITRE, and Ted Weresbanowski, ATSM Standards for Small UAS and formerly of AeroVironment.
That's right. We'll start off with Ted Weresbanowski, the STM Standards guy, talking about some of the history of small UAS.
And that's what led the FAA in the 2006 timeframe to actually stop allowing small UASs to be flown in the national airspace system under the provisions of model aircraft. And they issued a clarification of existing policy, which actually stopped all flying of small UASs. That sort of raised an uproar in the country. And then the FAA formed a small UAS aviation rulemaking committee, which I co-chaired, to offer recommendations to the FAA for a regulation that would allow small UASs to fly in the NAS. And the reason we focused on small UASs is because that's where we see the market, the near and midterm market, and that's why we brought these.
Okay, and you know, one aspect of this, David, that you'll find throughout is that all of the process we've been watching the FAA go through is not just driven by what the FAA has developed on their own. There have been committees, the ASTM has been involved, and others as well. And that kind of comes through. Sometimes we forget that, you know, we think that the FAA is dreaming this all up on their own, and they're not. They're using other resources as well.
Yeah, Max, I guess you're right that there's more involved to this than we've been involved with since we've been doing this over a year. it seemed like the freight train had left the station about a year ago, but Ted does bring up a point that this started in 2006, so we're now 8 years into the process, which is kind of surprising. You don't think of that when we talk about all this regulations. We seem to think it's been moving quite slowly based on the momentum over the last year or so, but clearly the FAA was kind of ahead of its time if we go back to 2006.
Yeah, it's been a long process for sure. I mean, when you introduce a new type of aircraft, and we get some comments to this effect later on, but when you introduce a new kind of aircraft to the national airspace, that's a big event. That is something that causes the sort of status quo in terms of regulations and so forth to kind of pause and say, okay, so how do we deal with this? It's sort of a discovery process. But the ASTM has been involved in this quite a bit, and Ted continues on with a little bit more history about some of the work, the recommendations they did and provided to the FAA, and this all leading up to the NPRM, which we're going to hear more about. So here's Ted.
So that small UAS ARC was formed. We provided those recommendations to the FAA in 2009, and the FAA has been working on a notice proposed rulemaking that they're about to issue, I believe, by the end of this year on what it would take to fly a small UAS, less than 55 pounds, within visual line of sight for civil applications, commercial applications. Part of those recommendations were to use consensus-based standards for the technical requirements that might be required or levied on a small UAS. So that was part of our recommendation to the FAA. They took that recommendation and signed an MOU with ASTM, which used to be the American Society of Testing Materials. It's no longer that, it's just ASTM, to develop standards for the topic areas that the FAA thought would be necessary to cover with consensus-based standards. We at ASTM now, I'm the chair of that committee, we are currently working on the standards to support that rule for the class of vehicles that you see out there. We've actually published 6 of them already. We've got several others in the works. We anticipate that they'll have to be revised once we actually see what's in the NPRM, because for legal reasons, we haven't been able to see what the FAA is really going to propose as a regulation. But we are working on that. If you'd like to participate in the development of those standards or just see what's going on, you can join ASTM. Go to ASTM.org. It costs you $75 a year. You get full access, voting rights, whatever. But that's sort of where we are right now with small UASs. The FAA is going to issue a notice of proposed rulemaking, and we in ASTM are developing standards.
All right. The NPRM, this is the next step in the process that gets us to some actual regulations, right? We've seen policy statements and such things from the FAA in the past. There's been some disagreement as to whether those policy statements are enforceable. You know, we see that with the suit, the Perker suit. Another thing that we'll see coming up is that all of these inputs to the FAA that are going to go into the NPRM, no one but the FAA knows what's going to be in that NPRM that we're going to see, that we're supposed to see in the next few months.
An NPRM is a notice of proposed rulemaking, which is the document that is basically what the FAA will put out to us to look at for us to give our opinions on. And usually they put out a public notice and then you can write your comments and respond. And usually it takes a couple of months just to get what they're thinking. So it's interesting that you have all of these outside organizations like ATSM submitting to the FAA, and the FAA is sort of behind the scenes combining everything into this NRPM. And then we see where we go from there.
So just to finish up with Ted, he also spent just a little bit of time mentioning the issue of spectrum allocation. So let's listen to Ted Weresmanowski again.
big issue that we're all dealing with right now, and you all deal with in your particular area, is in spectrum. And we are working with the World Radio Conference and the various entities within the U.S. to get spectrum allocated for the safe integration of UASs into the NAS, because that's one of the critical technologies, critical links, being able to fly these things safely in the NAS. So I think that covers.
All right, that's an example of one of the issues being faced and some of the activity that's going on kind of behind the scenes to address it.
And it's not something we've actually talked a lot about. I know we've had a couple of news stories about, when they say spectrum allocation, what radio frequencies we're supposed to be flying with. You know, there are specific channels and specific frequencies for EMS, for fire, for police, for secure channels for the military. And I guess that would be part of the FCC would be involved with the spectrum analysis, because I believe they have the rights to allocate the frequencies.
Right. It's a non-trivial issue for sure. A lot of drones, you know, quadcopters and things are using Wi-Fi, and whether that's really a sustainable method for providing the communications with UAS is kind of open to debate. But let's move on now to bring in Dean Griffith from the FAA. He was asked a question by the moderator, Mark Warren from Kroll and Mooring, and let's listen to that conversation.
You're the FAA lawyer, and Ted has kind of set the conditions of where we are right now. But what's up with the FAA? He talked about regulations and laws. Tell us a little bit more about that, and start off with, are UAS aircraft or are they something else?
Well, UAS are aircraft, Mark, and thank you also to the NBAA for having me today. Appreciate it. Congress was clear in our last reauthorization that unmanned aircraft are aircraft, and so that's basically how we're treating them. As part of that, we recently issued an interpretation of the special rule for model aircraft, which was Section 336 of that law. And within that, Congress basically drew a line and said, so if you're looking at UAS, looking at aircraft, on one side of this line, FAA, you are not to regulate. But for the rest, your enforcement authority is clear, and by the definition of that statute, that they are aircraft. And what Ted really talked about with the development of the rule really highlights that what we're looking at as an agency, which is we have the responsibility to maintain the safety of the national airspace system as well as people and property on the ground. And that's one of the reasons why the regulatory process is, some would say, long and cumbersome, and I might tend to agree with them, but that's part of the reason for that. We do, as an agency, have a plan for safe and staged integration of UAS into the national airspace system, and we are making progress to achieve that goal.
All right, that again was Dean Griffith from the FAA.
Interesting statement there about Congress has told the FAA that UASs are aircraft. It's a very, very telling statement that, you know, it's the allocation that the Congress had gave to the FAA has told them that, yes, you need to do this. Yes, they are aircraft. So not the FAA defining the rules, but Congress. Interesting.
Yes. And they refer several times, or Dean does several times, to the fact that the marching orders, if you will, come from Congress here, from that, what was the 2012 reauthorization bill, I think. And so really the FAA is trying to comply with what Congress has mandated that they adhere to. Coming up now, Dean Griffith from the FAA talks about some of the challenges faced.
What Ted talked about, and also I think what Mario's going to talk about later, really highlights some of the challenges the agency is facing, which is, we're really talking about a very broad range of vehicles and rapidly evolving technology that particularly now is becoming much more accessible to people. You can go spend a few $100 on Amazon and have yourself a pretty nice piece of equipment with a camera on it, maybe. And so that's, and I think Mario, I was here last at this convention center for the AUVSI Trade Association meeting, and the anecdote from that was the floor space dedicated to commercial UAS, when they first started, military application was by and large the primary floor, application for floor space, and now that switch is mostly commercial with the minority being military application. So I think that highlights the challenge to the FAA in terms of integrating civil UAS operations into the airspace. As Ted mentioned, we're going to have the rollout, or expecting the rollout by the end of the year, and that will be the MPRM for small UAS. It's under 55 pounds. You can reference our roadmap. All this information is available on our website, faa.gov/UAS. And that outlines our plan for integration down the road.
All right, so the roadmap is still the roadmap.
Yeah, well, the roadmap doesn't really say much. But I am getting kind of tired of the FAA using diversity as an excuse.
Yeah.
I guess they're entitled, but a small UAV, whether it's a fixed wing or a quadcopter, should be able to be regulated simultaneously. But they're constantly saying, you know, there's more diversity, therefore it's harder to regulate. I mean, regulation should be boiled down to the basics first and then broaden it out. Do you agree or no?
Yeah, I guess I don't like sort of dividing up the situation into lots of little pieces and saying this piece should have these kinds of regulations and that piece have those. In the end, they're all aircraft, right? And so safety is safety, privacy is privacy, and those issues should span, I think, the entire spectrum, all the way from small to large. Is that what you're thinking, David?
Yeah, agreed. It's just several times the FAA has said that we're having trouble handling this because it's so diverse. I can think of BD5Js, which have a wingspan shorter than my height, things to Paper Cubs or C5 Galaxies or AN-124s. Aircraft are a very diverse thing. They do different things. There's helicopters. I mean, they don't have any trouble regulating those, but I mean, they should be looking at it as UAVs are a class of aircraft, and we regulate it thusly. Not the fact that there are quadcopters as UAVs, and there are fixed wings, and there are medium altitude, long endurance ones, and there are high altitude, long. Kind of opinion is they're trying to overcomplicate something, and because of that, they're using that as an excuse to delay the process.
All right. Well, let's continue on. And Dean Griffith from the FAA talks about some of the next steps, and that they don't intend to work these things serially one after the other, but some of these things happen at the same time. So here's Dean again.
We internally, as an agency, are looking at what are the next steps after the small rule. So we're starting to think about that already, and that's the message I want to relay, is that, you know, we're not looking serially here. We are planning. We are looking to have to have a good approach to integration. One of the tools we're using, also as Ted mentioned, is our Aviation Rulemaking Committee, which helps to provide direction on integration. In terms of the progress we're making with the NPRM out by the end of the year, is one of the main goals. We have many public aircraft operators operating now under certificates of authorization. And I wanted to highlight a particular success that we've had with the emergency certificate of authorization, emergency COA, that we've issued in cases of for search and rescue for missing people, both in Texas and recently in Virginia, and also have issued them for search for missing people with the mudslides in the Northwest earlier in the year. And those could be issued by the FAA in a matter of hours or days. So that's something that I think demonstrates our seriousness here.
Yeah, I'm glad they've issued COAs for things like this that are time sensitive. Hours sounds pretty good. Days sounds kind of too long.
Well, originally it was for the wildfires, it was days to get the Reaper up there to do the wildfires. I think in Virginia it was hours. Now, keep in mind that when they do these authorizations, we've talked about this, their aircraft or UAVs that have COAs already. I mean, hours later they issued for the Virginia search and rescue, it was for a UAV that had a COA for the Maryland, Virginia, New Jersey test site. So that eliminates a lot of the paperwork if they're going to give a certificate of authorization to an aircraft they already have a certificate of authorization for. Now, the real challenge will be, I guess, if they have to authorize an aircraft they don't have a current COA for. It's an interesting thing, but let's not belittle the fact that it is quite an accomplishment that the FAA is getting this time down and recognizing the importance of search and rescue and using them for search and rescue.
All right, Griffith continues.
We have a goal to issue those exemptions within 120 days, which is our standard exemption metric, and we're serious about making that. Our test sites, we have all set six test sites up and running. We have bids in for the Center of Excellence to do additional research on UAS issues. And we're also issuing guidance to our inspectors on enforcement and our education first enforcement philosophy. So I think that those are some highlights about what the agency is doing now. And look forward to hearing your questions about it.
All right, next up we have, this is a really interesting comment that we get from the FAA, from Griffith. This is the moderator, Mark Warren, asking a question about a farmer using a quadcopter and if it's recreational or if it's commercial. So listen to this.
So if I'm a farmer who is a hobbyist, I can fly a very capable UAS over my fields as long as I'm doing it for recreational purposes and I meet the requirements of Section 336. And I could put a camera in it and I could take a picture of me and my family out in front of the house and I'm good for recreation purposes. But if I use it to survey my fields or check my livestock or make sure the fence line is intact, have I crossed a line into commercial use?
Yes, and that's one of the criteria that Congress made clear in Section 336, which is the special rule for model aircraft. They defined one of the criteria to define a model aircraft there is that it's used for hobby or recreation purposes. And as the FAA, we look at that as hobby or not hobby, I guess, so we're not even, you know, that's the line. So I guess a concept that's pretty familiar to Part 91 operators in particular is incidental to a business. Someone who's using an aircraft to go from meeting to meeting, for example, we although it's Part 91, it is incidental to a business, we would say that's not a hobby use. So that is the line that we're talking about.
So that's pretty explicit. That answers a question that we get from listeners all the time.
Hobbyists or non-hobbyists, or hobbyists and everybody else. That's probably the clearest definition we've gotten out of the FAA on where the line is.
Well, yeah, it's pretty explicit. If it's for your own little enjoyment that has no relationship to anything commercial, then it's a hobbyist application. But any time it begins to have any usefulness to a business, then that becomes commercial and is not allowable at this point. All right, Dean Griffith went on, and this is kind of a long clip, but here he talks about some of the challenges that the FAA has in meeting the congressional mandate.
Fair enough. So nonetheless, for all of those uses, all those kinds of applications, Congress, under the FAA Modernization and Reform Act, has given FAA its marching orders. And David said, you got to integrate UAS into the national airspace system by 2015. So what are the technological and operational challenges to accomplishing that? And can you do it?
Yeah, thanks, Mark, and thanks, NBAA. When I look at the advances in the unmanned aircraft, technologically just phenomenal. The flight control systems, the sensors, you really don't have to be a pilot to operate an unmanned aircraft system today. But the technology challenges are really in how do you integrate these devices into the national airspace system and do that safely and efficiently, recognizing there are a lot of other users in that airspace already. So I'd like to talk about the different elements of air traffic management, the key elements from my perspective, and just mention one or two key challenge areas to get you thinking about the complexity of the issue. So first and foremost, for a safe air traffic management, you need communications. In general, that's voice communications today, a lot of pilots here at the convention. In the future, with unmanned aircraft, it's going to be that control link that Ted mentioned, from the control station to the aircraft. We've now split out the cockpit from the body of the aircraft and made it remote. So a lot of times, in fact, people don't like the term unmanned aircraft. They talk about remotely piloted aircraft, and that's actually a better term, more accurate term, because the pilot or the operator is typically on the ground with the control station and very much dependent on that communications link, known as the C2 link for control communications. If that link isn't available, if it's not reliable, if it doesn't have high integrity, if it's easily jammed or spoofed, you're in big trouble. You lose connection to your aircraft. Those kind of problems just don't really exist in today's manned aviation. So we need communications. Ted mentioned the spectrum, the radio frequency spectrum. And fortunately, people are thinking ahead. The World Radio Conference has allocated spectrum for terrestrial networks, not yet for satellite networks. But we don't have a communication service provider. We don't have a network out there providing those C2 services in that protected band known as the Air Radio Navigation Services band, ARNS. This protected spectrum, what we have today is Wi-Fi. You see a lot of people flying their Parrots or whatever other model aircraft, unmanned aircraft, just using Wi-Fi, which is a regulated spectrum, but it's a shared use spectrum. So there's nothing to prevent communication collisions in RFI, radio frequency interference. So the comm link for the C2 function is absolutely critical. Navigation, you have to know where you are. Everybody knows GPS. Most people know WAAS, at least in this community, an augmentation to the GPS, the Wide Area Augmentation System. Combined gives you perfect position information where you can receive the low power signal. A lot of UAVs are going to be operating in airspace, atypical airspace, where you're going to have items that are going to block the signal. If you've ever been in a parking garage in your car and you try to turn on your GPS navigator, you'll know it doesn't work too well in there because the signal gets blocked, very low power. So we need to have alternative navigation sources for these, some unmanned aircraft, not all, but some depending on the use and what it is that they're doing and how safe you need that operation to be. I just think we can't rely on GPS alone, even augmented with WAAS. And then surveillance, that's one of my favorite topics. A lot of these aircraft are very small, so they are hard to be seen. And unless you're flying in the Class A, Class B, Class C airspace, where the ADS-B is going to be required in the future, or a Mode C transponder is required today, you're not going to be picked up by primary radar. These things just have very small cross-sections, radar cross-sections. You're not going to be visible. So I would hope, and it won't be required, but I would hope that most unmanned aircraft operators choose to equip their aircraft with some kind of electronic beacon, be it ADS-B or something of that nature. In fact, the FAA just last week released a new technical standard order, TSO, C-199, for a system called TABS, Traffic Awareness Broadcast System, I believe. And it's all about making your aircraft visible to others who happen to have TCAS on board their aircraft or some other ability to receive your ADS-B messages. So personally, I would require that, but I think it's going to be an optional thing, and I would encourage everybody to do it. My last point of technical integration is on the air traffic management system. You don't just hop in an airplane and fly through the NAS. You have a flight plan. It gets submitted to the FAA. It has to get ingested by the automation systems and presented to controllers in multiple FAA facilities. That would work fine, but a lot of the unmanned aircraft trajectories aren't your typical fly from point A to point B, take off and land. It's let's fly up and let's loiter, let's fly up and fly over my field, or let's fly up and be a high-altitude communications relay and stay stationary. So the flight plans tend to be quite a bit different than today's. And that's not so bad, except some of them can be for long periods of time. And I'm talking not just over a day or a week, but months, up to 5 or 6 months. And the system today can't handle flight plans for that duration. So we need to really work through some of the technical details about getting good flight plans that aren't just point to point, but really say I'm going to be operating in a certain area of volume, and making sure that the air traffic controllers understand who's there and what it is that they're doing.
Wow. That last comment about flight plans that last days, months, weeks is really interesting. And I don't think we've even remotely talked about, you know, we've talked about low altitude satellites, you know, like Google wants to have fly over. You're going to have to set up a flight plan and say that, yeah, it's going to be up doing this orbit for 6 months. Wow, that's a really telling challenge for integration into the airspace.
Yeah, I agree, David. And I think these comments kind of give you give all of us a good perspective of, you know, how the FAA is thinking about these issues and, you know, where they're coming from. And I think it's very insightful. Maybe just a couple of quick other clips as we're kind of drawing to a close here. We had Mark Warren ask Dave Hamrick from MITRE about some of the operational issues involved here.
Those are the technical issues. On the operational issues, just real quickly, it really depends on where you're flying. If you're out in Class G airspace, uncontrolled airspace, you're on your own. Typically, it's visual separation standards. Hopefully, the other aircraft will see you, and hopefully, you can see those others if you're operating within visual line of sight. But if you're going beyond visual line of sight, you need some kind of ability to do the separation function that air traffic control normally provides. And that gets into the whole issue of detect and avoid. How does your unmanned aircraft detect and avoid, stay well clear of other aircraft when the eyeballs are no longer in the cockpit? So those are some of the operational challenges that I see. And I'll just leave it at that. I'll be happy to talk more as questions come up. Thank you.
And then finally, Dave Hamrick from MITRE talks about, are there some benefits to manned aircraft that may come out of this technology that's being developed for unmanned aircraft?
So, Dave, I got a couple for you, actually. One is, am I right to assume that a lot of this equipment and technological and operational improvement will benefit manned aircraft as well as unmanned?
Yeah, really good point. I think that technologies like detect and avoid or stay well clear, once those get developed and the cost comes down, they're going to come back into the manned aviation, especially the low-end GA, where we still, unfortunately, today have a fairly high, unacceptably high mid-air collision rate. And that technology can help this GA pilot have better situational awareness and provide advisory services, if need be, to stay well clear of and avoid collisions without the expense of a high-end system like TCAS as we know it today. So absolutely, it's going to come back into the manned aviation.
There's something else we hadn't really considered.
No, and we can't let Rob know that his GA universe will benefit from UAVs. This has been a really enlightening conversation, and thanks, Carl. I mean, that's all. just a little anecdote. I knew that Max was excited because he doesn't ever instant message me via phone during the week unless something dramatic has happened. And he was over the moon when he got this. And I guess the question is this, folks. Do you want to hear the rest of the other half? Should we set aside another episode to do the second half of the panel discussion, which has topics like pilot's licenses, should we, right? Or the social risks with UAS is like privacy or unmanned commercial passenger or cargo flights in the future. And this one, I really want, I like the answer of where did the 55-pound line come from? And we're not talking about kite flight line. We're talking about 55 pounds for small UAs or smaller. So what do you think, Max? You think our listeners should send us an email at feedback@theuavdigest.com to see if they want to hear the rest of it?
Yeah, absolutely. We'd like to present it, but let us know your thoughts if that you find this valuable or not. So meantime, we want to thank you for listening to this episode, episode 65 of the UAV Digest. You can find us at theuavdigest.com, and you can go straight to the show notes at theuavdigest.com/65.
And of course, our website is theuavdigest.com. On Twitter, you can find us at @UAVDigest. On Facebook, it's facebook.com/UAVDigest. And of course, iTunes and Stitcher. If you're streaming us to your phone, leave us a review if you love us. That way other people can find us. Likewise on iTunes. And if you want some swag, you could always go to cafepress.com/theuavdigest. And of course, we would love to for you to become a patron of us so that maybe next year Max and I can go to MBAA and get better audio quality, though we will, again, really appreciate Carl for doing what he did. Unannounced, and we appreciate it. And you need to definitely check out his two websites. If you haven't, even if you're not a pilot, Stock Mike Avcast is pretty funny. It's an entertaining bunch of people. And his Aviation Careers is an amazing podcast. It's helped a lot of people and talks about things other than being a pilot. There's a lot of careers out there in aviation that if I could go back 20 or 30 years, I would say, yeah, I might be doing something different than selling insurance during the day. So we'd like to thank Carl Valeri for taking the time and helping us bring this important panel to you.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thanks, Carl. So this has been Max in Hartford.
And David in Philly. Thanks for listening.
This episode has been sponsored by UAV Propulsion Tech, a provider of propulsion, servo, and rescue and recovery parachute solutions for the unmanned aerial vehicle market. For more information, check out www.uavpropulsiontech.com.